Welcome to Mysterious Goings On, the podcast about creativity, writing, and mystery. Every week, we talk about all kinds of great fiction and meet the people who write it. We also feature explorations about creativity in all walks of life. Your host, Alex Greenwood, will join you right after this.
Hey, listeners, just want to take a minute to let you know the folks at Crowd Ultra have named Mysterious Goings On in their top five literature podcasts of the year. They put out a contest or submission process for 75 plus award categories across the podcast spectrum, the best of all things with a crowd, and Mysterious Goings On has made the top five in literature. I am very excited about this, very gratified, and I just want to thank all the listeners who helped make this possible. Again, Crowd Ultra is part free, all-in-one event and audience interaction app, part ticketing platform, and part social network. And it features over 100 categories among segments. They provide value to including events, podcasting, event talent, and event planning. It's a tool. I don't use the tool, just so you know, but I'm looking into it. The important thing, though, is to let you know that, again, Mysterious Goings On is in the top five. They'll let us know who the actual number one is soon, I think in the new year, but I just had to stop the action for a minute to tell you about it. And sincerely, thank you for all your support of the show. You know, there's something great about a sequel. And the thing that I think most people find, particularly readers, interesting and great about a sequel is because if they fall in love, they want to keep the relationship going. You know, you can see that also with films. You see that with all kinds of things. You even see it with podcasts. Guess what? We've got a sequel here. Not only have we had our current guest, today's guest, on more than once, we've had him on. This will be our third time. So honored to have Bert Weisberg with us. He is a novelist, screenwriter, and producer of feature films. There's so much we could talk about here, and we'll get into it. But if you haven't listened to the previous couple episodes with Bert, go to the show notes, click on those links, and listen. You're in for a treat. We hear so many stories about his career in Hollywood and his thoughts behind writing great stories and great fiction. So we're going to continue that, I hope, today with the sequel. Sometimes they say that third sequel isn't successful. I'm here to say it will be. Bert Weisberg, welcome back to Mysterious Goings On.
Thank you very much for having me. And I agree with you. The third is going to be the charm.
Okay, let's just go back. I haven't talked to you in a little while. It's been a minute, as they say these days. What you been up to? How are you been? Let's just talk a little bit about that. I mean, we're out of COVID. What's been going on with you besides the writing? Anything new or just keeping on?
You know, I spent a lot of time working on the new book. I was very involved. And one of the things that worked for me, I mean, I shouldn't describe it this way, but COVID really gave me the opportunity to stay home and write all the time and take it in a way that was more intense than I generally do. And so I was appreciative about it. But that, you know, aside from getting older, which is absolutely no fun, that's mostly what I've been doing, and really happy with how it came out, the book.
Yeah, you know, I was telling another author I was interviewing recently that I unfortunately kind of lost my discipline during COVID. I just lost focus, and he said the same thing. And so you're one of those rare writers that I've spoken to, at least, who had the discipline to keep going and to double down a little bit. So my hat's off to you, sir. Let's see here. Well, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say, I'm not sure that I deserve this credit. I mean, it was really the only way that I could keep myself sort of from getting overwhelmed by COVID. You know, it really was I live on Long Island near the water, or on the water, and it was so beautiful. And just writing here was sort of a way to get away from all the troubles in the world. And that's just
It's good therapy, isn't it? It really can be, and gets you through these rough areas. And since I've come back to the page, it's really helped me reintegrate a little bit into the world. So we all find our solace where we can. Well, let's talk about the return of Callie James. Now, folks, if you don't know, Callie James, she's a celebrated restaurateur, and she's got a bad boy bartender, Cash Logan. And they were both introduced to readers. As I said, go listen to our show. You can learn more about this previously. The links are in the show notes. But they were released and introduced in 2020 with Danger in Plain Sight. It's a thrilling page turner. And it was re-released this year, I believe, as a joint venture with Rare Bird Books and Blue City Press. And just a few short weeks later, what do we find out? Bert returns with Callie and Cash in Rough Justice. First of all, if you don't mind me asking, if it's just business stuff, no problem. We don't have to discuss it. But you had it re-released, a new venture. Was that something on the horizon, or a pleasant surprise, or how did that happen?
Well, this is the beginning of re-releasing all my books.
Oh.
You know, I went back into business with Rare Bird, who originally produced. Published, you know, I still talk like a film producer.
Yeah, <you do.
laughs> published my books in 2013. The first one was Inside Passage.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, these books have a long life, and they're not easy to reach a large audience because they're very complicated. They really deal with complex psychological issues, and they're really character driven in ways that, you know, you have to learn to, you have to want that. And so, you know, my original publisher and I decided that we would start by re-releasing Danger in Plain Sight, because it's a good way to present Rough Justice, the new book. And then we would go back and re-release all of them. And cool. You know, we haven't done that yet, but you can see the new cover on Danger in Plain Sight, which is great. And we have the same person who's going to be doing the cover for the other books. And I'm thrilled to just be revisiting all of them, because I think that these are books that are not, you know, they don't get old over time. I mean, character complexity doesn't go out of style.
Right.
And so I was very happy to be able to revisit Cash and Callie, and I took the occasion to do a different kind of book for me. I mean, what I think of as a different kind of book. And I don't know if you'd like me to talk about that, but I'd be happy to.
I wish you would. Go.
Normally, in a series of, and you have a, you know, what happened with Cash and Callie and Danger in Plain Sight was they fell in love. Yeah. And so this is a year later, and they're happily eating dinner at her restaurant. And they're really very much in love against all odds. And, you know, that's a sort of happy family. It's a very unconventional family with, you know, this crew of ragtag characters that they've, you know, sort of surrounded themselves with. But that when the book starts, an unexpected 25-year-old half Algerian woman shows up at the restaurant with a very complicated story. They've tried to kill her, they've stolen her identity, and she has a secret to tell these people. And conventionally, when you write a book like that, what you do is you talk about all the troubles that she creates in a family that's sort of not sure how to deal with a new person. And I went the other way. I said, I want to write a book about unconventional people who are not what you expect, who are very healthy, who are very able to include a new person, who are able to create, you know, sort of a home for her. And she was an orphan, and, you know, without going into the details, which would give away stuff which is not helpful. Suffice it to say that this book becomes about how she comes into her own. and how she changes the lives of Cash and Callie and all the people around her. And it's done in the context of a thriller where it takes you around the world. It actually ends up in Cuba. And they do some very audacious things to save her life. And I just was very happy. It's a happy book. You just like seeing her with these, you know, these odd people who don't fit into any categories that you're used to. And you see them functioning extremely well. And I really enjoyed that. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what I tried to do.
Yeah, I think that's interesting the way you describe how positive it is. Yeah, there's a loving relationship amongst this ragtag group that has come together in defense of this new person to their circle.
That's exactly right. And it shows you the sort of the difference between perceived reality and real reality. I mean, you know, these are people who, if you just look at them, they're smugglers, they're diamond traders. I mean, they do all sorts of things that you don't really expect complicated, psychologically able people to do. And at the same time, they're very sensitive and very kind and generous and able to create a healthy environment. And that was fun to write.
You know, if I could step back, I was going to comment. You beat me to it a little bit, though. I love how the new cover, and I love the cover style. And I'm thrilled to hear it's the same artist who's going to basically reskin all of your books. I did that a few years ago with mine, and not only did my sales go up, but I think just the general appreciation for the books went up because there was just a continuity there people could see artistically with that eye. So I just wanted to tell you that. I think the new covers are very exciting, very interesting to look at.
Well, I share your experience, which is that if the covers connect in some way, even though they're not directly connected, it interests people. Yeah. And, you know, I think the new cover is going to help sales a lot.
Yeah, I think it too, that it interests people, but I think it also kind of says to them, because they look at that cover aesthetic and they're like, this is a part of a little club I'm into here of you know, we get this aesthetic says, you know, we get this fiction, we get these stories, we get Callie, and they're going to get all your other books too. So I really love that. So Danger in Plain Sight, and now we have Rust Justice, and I probably said this to you before, and I'll say it again, because you started your career in Hollywood and you had a production company, you produced films including Ghost Story, and we've talked about that in previous you did Raggedy Man. We've talked about that in previous appearances here on the show. I'm just curious. I mean, I think it's, I'll just say it. I think that that Callie should have her own Netflix series. I mean, surely I'm not the only one who said that to you.
Well, we're hoping we can do that. I mean, we were waiting for the new book to come out. And, you know, we tried and we came close to doing, you know, a series of long form television, which I think is the most exciting thing going on in entertainment today. And we should talk about Yellowstone, because I think that's relevant to that. But when we came pretty close, but we didn't get there. It's still hard to get anything made, you know, on TV. And so we're going to go out again with Rough Justice, and we're going to try to do the whole Cash and Callie series as long-form television. We'll see.
You know, it's the beginning of the year. I actually had a deal, Bert. I broke a story and wrote a treatment for an indie producer, and then had the screenplay contract. And then, unfortunately, and he'd had a Netflix deal previously for another film. And he was pitching, and unfortunately he passed away. Yeah, it's just a sad story. I really loved working with the guy too. It was like, it was a whole new world for me. But the point being, he had told me even then, he passed away last March, and he was pitching our film in January and February. And one of the last things he said was, as even though, you know, he could get a meeting at Netflix, no problem. He said they were interested, but he said they were a little hesitant in general, because, and he ascribed that to what happened at the beginning of the year with Netflix, where they just they realized they were spending so much money, and you know, and then Netflix started to crater with their stock price and all these things happened. So I was going to ask you, have you perceived the same thing with the streamers? Are they pulling back a little bit, in your opinion? What do you think?
Well, you know, you're asking a good question, and I really can't answer it. I mean, I'm feeling like more and more like I'm sort of a Neanderthal, you know, that there's a whole new world out there, and I'm having to learn about it. I mean, we're actually been invited to do a couple of panels at the Film Summit in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we're going to do is we're going to do, I hope, I mean, I'm meeting with them on Friday to talk about specifics, but we hope we'll do one panel, and I'll bring people from Hollywood for this, about the Golden Age, which I would characterize from 1967 to 1980. And that's, you know, between Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate and Heaven's Gate. Yep. And then we will do another one about what's happened and how there is a kind of renaissance. I mean, there's been a long time where movies was, you know, just mostly for kids. But now in television, there's all sorts of very original and, you know, not unlike the kind of stuff that was being done in the 80s or the 70s, where people are taking risks and they're having, in this case, a long time to tell their stories. And you have things like Yellowstone, which I think are comparable to The Godfather. You know, I think they're that good. And I don't understand all the new ways that you can sell things. I haven't been through that. I'm about to go through it and I'll know more. But I think there are opportunities out there and that is just beginning.
I agree. And I speak to a lot of writers in my cohort who have not had your degree of success, but are very talented like yourself. And we're all talking about, you know, we would rather be in today's world, like you just said, with all these opportunities on television. You know, when you think back, Bert, I am old enough to remember that thinking back to TV when the miniseries, Rich Man, Poor Man, Roots, the miniseries that could just consume so much attention. Now, those days are probably over because we have a million channels. But what's great about it, though, is that same vibe. If you have a quality product, like you're talking about Yellowstone, and I'm talking about Callie and Cash Thrillers, by the way, is if you have quality material, there are some really wonderful places where it can not only get a showcase, but can be developed over time.
Well, I think that's a great thing. And one of the reasons that so many of the best writers have gone into this, into TV, is because they can tell stories, you know, 10 hours. It's not an hour and a half like a movie, but, you know, a one season of Yellowstone is more than 10 hours, in fact. They have 13 series and some of them are an hour and a half. And it's such an opportunity to do things with character that you just don't, you rarely get a chance to do in a movie. And
I totally agree. So I wish you luck and as you get into this, and I hope you'll report back from the front when you start getting deep into it.
I hope I have some success with it.
Yes, please. You're going to have to come back for another, for a fourth appearance, especially if you sell your show. But no, Callie James is such good stuff. I have to ask, on behalf of people who've listened to this show previously and who read this stuff and they haven't read Rough Justice yet, we know this thing starts out at the Bronze Pig. Please tell me there's some great food scenes in this book.
There are. And I can people tease me about it, but I love that stuff.
I told you before, I think I said, you know, you put me in the same mind of Robert Parker with the Spencer series, because he was always cooking and always made me so damn hungry. And you're one of the you're one of the first writers since him that can do that same thing to me. You know, I'm on a diet right now.
Compliment. I share that with Spencer.
You do, and you do it so well. It's so great. I still think back to that deli scene in the last book. I think there's just so much stuff there where I can smell the food. I can taste the food. It's your magnificent facility with describing that stuff. That's great. And
Let me interrupt for one second, because one of the treats in this new book is the Cuban food.
Ooh, ooh.
That's just a taste.
I was going to say, is that just a taste? It's a little amuse bouche. You're not going to tell us more, but I'm looking forward to hearing. I haven't got a chance to this one. I'm going to be reading this over the holiday, so I'm excited about this. And over the holiday, I'll be off my diet, so I can enjoy it. tell the listeners, if you don't mind, about your other stuff real quick while we got you.
The other books?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The first book is Inside Passage, and it was actually started as a screenplay when I had left Hollywood, and I wrote, you know, I moved to Bainbridge Island outside of Seattle, and I was very interested in the women, a couple of women that I knew there who went to Alaska in the summer to fish, and it's very dangerous, you know, it's those long days, and the water is pretty treacherous, and the weather is unpredictable, and they're very able women and very competent in wilderness. And I was interested in writing about a woman who was very good dealing hard things outside, but not very self-aware. And I start by, she's coming out of jail, and she was framed, and all she wants is to get her son back, who's in foster care. And the person that put her in jail, framed her, is running for state's attorney. And so that there's a lot of, this is a very tightly wound book. So she goes to a therapist because she has to get an adjudication. It's a way that, that somebody, a professional, can tell the people with foster care that she's a capable mother. So it's not around any internal problems, but it's more around wanting to get her son back. And this, well, he's a psychiatrist, name is Abe, becomes a character in all three books, and he couldn't be more different than her. Right, this is a guy that he can't drive because he's always sideswiping cars. I mean, he sort of lives in his mind, and he's very insightful and very understanding of complexities and character, but he's just not very good in the world. So this is a very unlikely couple. And at the beginning, he doesn't really believe her. I mean, he doesn't, you know, she tells him stuff and it doesn't make sense to her that, you know, why was she in jail? Why didn't she fight if she was, you know, set up? Why didn't she tell that to the court? And, you know, then she's in danger again because the guy that set her up goes after her, and she has to leave and go up the Inside Passage where she's very comfortable on her boat. And Abe, the psychiatrist, realizes that he's made a mistake, and he goes to find her. Now, that's really an experience for him out there. And long story short, they fall in love, and they have a wonderful relationship. And he saves her life, and he really is able to, you know, combine his skills with hers. And together, they are able to stop the guy that's, and I've left out an important element of this, and that's what I meant when I said it's very tightly wound. It turns out, and this is a great moment in the book, that his mother, who's a big problem for him, has always been like I shouldn't say this, but that's not unusual for a psychiatrist. And turns out that his mother is dating the guy that framed her. And so that really makes for a mess. And at the end, you know, Abe is able to save her life. He actually kills the person that's trying to frame her yet again. And the idea of him killing somebody is quite unexpected and very surprising in the book. Yeah. And quite moving, I think. Yeah. And they end up being married, and that leads us to the second book. second book. By the second book, they're married. You want me to go ahead?
Yeah, give us some more capsules on these. Yeah, let's. Yeah, this is the Corey Logan trilogy. Yeah,
is called Teaser, and Teaser is a pretty dark book. And Teaser is a guy who is abused in prison, and unstable, and in any event, he's in an attempt to get revenge on the man who abused him. He kidnaps a young girl who is a school friend of Corey's son. And that gets them involved. And this is a lot of action in this book. And they are able to save the girl's life and eventually stop Teaser. But this is really more a book about young people and mm-hmm. about what's going on in the schools. And I wrote it at a time that my kids were in private schools in Seattle or in public schools on Bainbridge Island. And I was on various school boards for both. And I was very interested in what's going on with kids around Seattle. And Seattle is a very, you know, sort of unconventional place in some ways, and the kids really go off in different directions, and you see it a lot of different ways, especially at that time where kids were experimenting in ways that weren't always healthy. And I explore that and why it happens and sort of how to parents have to deal with it. And this is a book that was very much liked by teenagers because it's about young people. And I don't want to say too much more about it because it's one where you won't enjoy it if I tell you what happens.
Right.
And the third one in the Corey Logan trilogy is called Minos. And that's really Abe's book. And again, this is an interesting premise. He has a patient, a young woman, who has created a whole mythological world. And there are Greek evil people. In her world that are threatening her and her friends, and makes no sense. I mean, it's really taken out of old, 500 BC stuff. And Abe has to get inside her world. He has to really understand because he believes that she's seeing and hearing something, even though she can't articulate it. And of course she is. And, kids are dying because these people that she's afraid of are real. And again, in this case, Corey is the one who tells Abe to go outside the box, as it were, and go into her world. If you want to help her, if you want to find out what's going on, you got to understand what this stuff means. And he does. And it's a very unconventional therapeutic relationship where he is participating in some of the rites and, things that she does to protect herself. And they figure it out. And again, I'm not going to tell you what happens, but this is very exciting. And it's very wonderful to see how Abe is able to bring this very disturbed girl back to life. And I really like, we went to Greece to take pictures at Delphi, which takes place in the book. And some of those pictures are in the book. And
Fantastic. And then you've got another kind of a standalone called In Velvet, which takes place at Yellowstone, right?
Yeah. And that's, of all my books, it's not connected to any of the others. And I spent a lot of time in Yellowstone with my kids, fishing and just exploring. And I love Yellowstone. And I wanted to write something that really celebrated. And the way I came at it was I worked with a bear biologist, and we sort of took as a premise, what if there was unseasonal animal behavior? So you have bears, grizzly bears, denning in the summer. You know, you have fish spawning the wrong time of year, and nobody can understand why. And of course, that's becomes involved in a very big plot of scientific nonsense that is being perpetrated by the government in the park, in the hot springs. And again, it becomes very dramatic and very violent before the end. And our hero, our heroine, and our hero, who are both, who are formerly partners and who come back together in the course of this book, really do some impressive work based on doing unconventional things. So I have always liked that book.
Yeah, the tagline, Irish elk have been extinct for thousands of years. What are they doing in Yellowstone National Park? I've not been to Yellowstone, but it's on my list. And I was just actually reading a book about, it's kind of macabre, it's about deaths in Yellowstone and the hot springs and just how people don't fully understand how dangerous those things are. And people who don't really understand that Yellowstone is a national park, it is not Disney World. You've got to be careful there. Just as an aside, that book, it was just interesting to read that and to think about how a lot of people don't fully, they don't fully appreciate and respect nature. I don't think, not everybody, at least.
Well, you know, the stories I learned about Yellowstone, I mean, this is a true story. Some guy put, you know, what was it? Honey on his wife's face in the car. Oh. So the bear would lick his face. He could take a picture. And of course the bear ate her.
Oh my God. I'm sorry. I'm speechless. Go ahead.
No, but there's all these stories of people putting their kids on top of a buffalo, you know, and these are all very dangerous animals and are not to be played with, you know, ever.
No. Yeah, I've seen video of people doing that, having their children nearby, and it's just terrifying that people are that ridiculously stupid, just to be honest. But these books, you know what? Critic John McCaffrey said that Weisbord's writing reminds me of the great Raymond Chandler mysteries, in that there is a tight, clear, hard-hitting prose coupled with great vulnerability in the characters. Plus, his attention to detail when it comes to settings is precise like Chandler and helps set a tone. Couldn't have said it better myself. And it's the hallmark, listeners, of Bert Weisbord's prose, his fiction. It is exactly this attention to detail. And of course, he's been on a couple of times, but if you listen to previous episodes, you'll note that Bert knew the great Ross McDonald. So he definitely comes by it honestly with the great comparisons to the famous noir writers as well. But you know, Bert, the thing that I love is, and you've just told it, by talking about all these books that you've done, you always have, or maybe always is not the right word, but you often have a male-female team to be the protagonist. That's a thing with you. You really like the team approach.
Well, you're right. And, you know, whenever I start talking about the books, I feel like I do a bad job. So I apologize. I mean, I can't do it. You know, I was thinking about the way I talked about In Velvet, and it's such a complicated story and it's so carefully worked out, and I don't do it justice, but you're at the center of it. The center of it, and what always makes it work, is the relationships. It's that, you know, this woman who is a bear biologist who first sees these bears behaving unseasonally, and of course nobody believes her, right. And her ex-partner who trusts her even though they don't get along very well, and gives her more confidence. And it's in that relationship that the whole story unfolds. And that's what makes the story have an emotional center, which is that you want these two people to get together and you want them to understand the things that they have missed about each other. And that's really at the heart of all the books, is some person who is usually functioning below their capacity.
Yeah.
You know, it's clear in Corey and Abe, you know, where Abe really helps Corey realize her abilities. I mean, she becomes very self-aware and becomes able to really have relationships. And it's the same thing with Rachel in Velvet. Well, I can't really find the spot, but Rainey is the man's name, and he's a fisherman. And, you know, again, I often have guys like Cash and Rainey who are not what you think. You know, they're not lawyers or doctors, and they're very able at what they do. They're also unafraid to do, and this is one of the things that I believe about people who are very self-aware. They're able to take some risks that a lot of people won't take when it's important, because they know that it's important to them, that it was in order to be the person they want to be, in order to be able to do the things that they have to do, they sometimes have to take risks. And that's sort of, I don't know that I'm really answering your question it's a very long-winded way to answer it, but it's watching Rainey get to Rachel and help her realize what her capacities are. Mm-hmm. And in that sort of process, and you know, it goes two ways, because he's got his limitations too, and you know, he's had trouble with relationships and so on and so forth. And these, over time, you see these people helping each other and you get some satisfaction. And I should say this as an aside, that I make sure that they always have to earn it.
Yeah.
These kind of changes do not come easily. It's not like you wake up feeling different. And you got to do hard things and you have to take risks and you have to talk. You have to be able to articulate to the people you're trying to reach in ways that you weren't able to articulate before. And it's in that you see the satisfaction of people really changing and being able to do things by the end of the book that they couldn't do at the beginning.
That's another reason I love your work, Bird, is all of your books. Okay, you've had 6 novels. All of them are character-driven thrillers. And you write these complicated folks who are able to, through their finding within themselves, but also through their affiliations with other characters, they're able to do these things that solve the case and helps them survive and moves things forward. So I think that is what keeps people coming back to your stuff. I really do.
Well, it's where I have the most fun, which is sort of, you know, making it, having them do things you don't expect them to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to interject and say, yeah, you know, I don't write particularly complicated mysteries. What I do try to do is write complicated people in mysterious situations, and it seems to work for me.
Well, that's exactly what I do too. I mean, that's exactly where I think the secret is.
Exactly. We've just got a couple more moments left, but I'd be remiss if I didn't tell people, hey, folks, listeners, BurtWeisbord.com. You'll find the link in the show notes. No need to go stop off the treadmill or stop the car in traffic. You can just click on the link there. I want to direct your attention not only to Burt's books, but I want you to go check out his blog post, particularly if you are a writer. I love the blog post Burt puts out talking about not only his current work and of course trying to sell some books, of course, but he talks about things like how screenplays and movies influenced his novel writing. He has a great essay about how Clute, great movie, Jane Fonda, Donald Sutherland, how that screenplay and others influenced his novel, how great screenplay shaped his writing as a novelist. It's a class for all of you aspiring writers and screenwriters. You need to go look at this on Bert's website. And that leads me to the actual question, Bert, is you really are all about letting everybody kind of see the man behind the curtain. You are not mysterious or precious about your approach to the craft, are you? You tell people what's up with you.
That happened. It was not necessarily conscious, but I ended up doing that. I mean, I just feel like it's the best way to explain what I'm trying to do. And it's not a secret. I mean, it's just, it's hard work. And you know, there is no question that my experience with screenwriters is really where it started. I mean, because what you know about screenwriting is that you can't do these long interior monologues. And, you know, working with great screenwriters who are able to, I mean, look at somebody like Alvin Sargent, who in Julia are Ordinary People, who are able to do, I mean, the therapy sequences in Ordinary People, or in Clute for that matter. You know, I work with Andy Lewis on four screenplays, and they do these wonderful therapy sessions, which was not conventional in those times, and they do them extremely well with very little interior monologue. And, you know, I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but
you are.
The answer really is that thinking about that and talking about those things and writing about them when it's appropriate is a good way to be in touch with readers.
You know, sorry, Bert, I keep flipping back to myself a little bit here, but it's my context with you on this. But in my series, my character goes to a therapist, and you get through dialogue, not it, just as you said. It's not much interior. It's the dialogue between John Pilot, my character, and his therapist. The best compliment I had was my latest book came out. A fella emailed me and said, that is some of the best dialogue I've seen between a person and their therapist. And of course, I probably cheated a little because a lot of it's probably from my own sessions. But the point being, like you said, I don't want to sit there and be stuck in the guy's stewing in the guy's mind about the session. I want the words in the session to speak for it. And that's what you do. I think it's a great lesson for writers to learn.
I'd love to read that book.
Oh, I'll send you one, Bert. I was going to tell you, this is the first one that Kirk has really said some nice things about. So I'd be proud to send it to you.
No, I'd love to do that. And you know, when I wrote Inside Passage I wrote a sequence where Abe, the therapist, talks about what therapy was like for him and how it changed him. And, you know, I was in a writer's group at that time. This is a long time ago. And she was a psychoanalyst. And she asked me if she could use that sequence to give to her patients. And I was so touched by that, you know, she felt it was just the kind of thing that really explained what she was trying to do. And
wow. That's the highest compliment right there, to actually want to do that and want to share that. That's part of what we're doing here, isn't it, Bert? That's part of what we're doing here. We're just that verisimilitude. We're trying to reach people, do it in a realistic way, but still tell fantastic stories. I hate to say this, and I've only talked with you now for almost 3 hours total, and I still have so much more I'd like to learn and ask, but I also know that everybody's busy, including you. So, hey, Bert, the website is bertweisbord.com. Anything else you want to allow before we call it a day here?
No, just thank you. I mean, this is always a pleasure for me. Again, I apologize. I'm not better at describing my books. I mean, I will never be good at that. I mean, I just know that. But I appreciate your patience and your thoughtfulness. So this was a pleasure.
Oh, Bert, that's fine. And you know what? If we were both really great at talking about our books, nobody'd read them, right? So why would we want to?
That's
you know?
Right.
Oh, man. Ladies and gentlemen, the great Bert Weisbord. If you've not read the Corey Logan trilogy or definitely not the Callie and Cash thrillers, you got to get on those. Go to his website. They're also available wherever books are sold. He's won tons of awards. I'm not going to embarrass him by listing him here, but you can see it all on his website, BertWeisbord.com. And again, it's in your show notes and it's at mgopod.com. Good sir, I hope you have a wonderful holiday season, and I would look forward to and hope to speak with you a fourth time when your next book or project rolls around.
Thank you very much, and we'll make a point to do that.
Hey there, listeners. Alex Greenwood here. You know, one thing I love about hosting Mysterious Goings On is I get to ask the questions I'd want answered if I wasn't the host. That's the questions I ask. But also, I don't just ask questions. I have a give and take. I have a conversation. And I have it on a pretty good authority that the guests really like that style. Don't believe me? Listen to John Gilstrap, New York Times bestselling author of Blue Fire, Crimson Phoenix, and lots more.
You know, I would tell you that I've been doing this for 26 years, so I don't know how many interviews I've done over time, but this is my favorite kind. I like having a discussion. Less experienced interviewers have their list of questions, and you answer their question. And if during the course of answering their question, you confess to the Kennedy assassination, they won't pursue that because they've got to get on to the next question. You know?
It's question seven. Thank you, Mr. Oswald. Yes.
Where do you get your ideas?
That's your favorite question, isn't it?
That is.
There, what can I tell you? Right from the horse's mouth. We have a good time on Mysterious Goings On, and I hope you'll subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, if you want to learn more, go to mgopod.com. Thanks so much for listening, and of course, keep reading.
Thanks for joining us on Mysterious Goings On. Be sure to follow Mysterious Goings On wherever you get your podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget, you can get the links to books and other things mentioned on the show at mgopod.com. Until next time, keep reading.